Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling, brought to you by Zwift, where fun is fast. I'm Graham Wilgos. Brad, the weekend part two.
Yes.
An awesomely exciting day of the at the Giro.
Absolutely great. Bernal taking pink and the stage and marking their, you know, their dominance of what they do so well, which is lead Grand Tours.
Indeed. And here to talk about it with us...
Ola Shinua.
Hello.
Ola Shinua, I want to say.
Shinua. I never get it right, do I?
It's so close. It's so close. We'll go with it. Been called worse.
Epic stage today from start to finish.
It was brutal, wasn't it? It's one of those days that I think this is why I sit on a sofa watching it rather than ever try to ride my bike in anger. Another horrible day to get in the breakaway. But what a fantastic finale. And I think most of us thought that breakaway was going to stay. Certainly when we came up to the last kilometer, we still had Koen Bouwman and Geoffrey Bouchard up front. But then Egan Bernal just lit the whole stage. It was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, he looked like he was riding a different race. He went past the two front runners so quickly.
He looked like the Egan Bernal that we became accustomed to a few years ago, that won the Tour de France. I spoke a lot about him sort of being a little bit, there was an element of vulnerability about him with coming into this race and the uncertainty, and Geraint sort of being given the leadership back of the Tour de France and Egan going for the Giro, and he stepped up to the mark. And I think he sort of walked that line of insecurity a little bit, because in his post-race interview, he spoke about sort of his teammates encouraging him, saying, no, Egan, you can really do this. And saw Jani Moscon really giving it some beans for him up that last climb. And, you know, he needed that for himself, and I think the team would have encouraged that.
Do you know, I was wondering what he was doing yesterday, actually, when it was so hard to get in that breakaway, and he got into one of the early breakaways until people were like, excuse me, drop back, thank you. What do you think that was about?
Well, I think he just sort of fell into it, really, by trying to be in the front of the race. Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with Egan. You know, if he's in a move like that, that's never going to go clear. Mm. So, you know, he's going to have to fall away from it. But so, like I said, it's sometimes best to be on the offensive than falling way in behind.
He said he wasn't sure how his back would fare today in his pre-race.
Which isn't a great sign, isn't it, really? And it just shows that it's on his mind constantly, isn't it? That's not a great thing to say for your competitors.
This has been the big thing for me, and I didn't have time to talk about it in our post-race show. Doing really well today is one thing. It gives us absolutely no indication as to actually how his back is doing.
No.
And that's what's going to be the biggest test. We know he's got the form, he's got the legs, he's got the right mentality in terms of his aggressive attacking, but we have still got no idea how his back is going to fare over the next 2 weeks. And that's what makes the race really exciting.
Yeah, to say something like that, it's clearly there still niggling in the background.
Or is that mind games though?
No.
Well, not with Egan. Egan's such an honest, sort of humble guy, isn't he? In some ways, it's to his detriment that he speaks what's on his mind.
I was going to say.
A bit like I used to do.
You would think if he's going to play mind games, he would just ignore the back. He wouldn't even reference it. I'm surprised that he did say it at all, you know, because that makes the others sense vulnerability. Whereas you want them to think, especially the way that Ineos Grenadiers have been riding this, you want the others to think now they're unbeatable, you know, and have them on the back foot, which they are, really, but... Yeah, I find that intriguing that he even said it.
Sean Kelly was saying that the way he was riding on that final gravel section in the big ring wasn't going to do his back any good.
Well, I mean, yeah, but it was going to do him good for getting time, wasn't it? It shows the strength he's got. If his efforts are gauged and judged on whether his back's going to be okay or not, then he's going to be in for a long Giro, isn't he? And it's not a good sign. The fact we're talking about it already isn't a good sign. And from what I understand, I think that's the first time he's mentioned it the whole race, is that right?
Yeah, it's the first that
so
I've heard.
So it shows that, you know, it's by no means a done deal, even though he's good on his day. You know, I think the more workload he does, the more efforts he makes like that, is it going to become a problem? Well, I think we'll find out.
It was his first Grand Tour stage win, which is a surprise.
Yeah, well,
I think we all forget.
Yeah, because he was away in Tien, and obviously the stage got cancelled, didn't it?
And it looked for all the world like he was gonna win that.
Well,
before,
I still think Geraint would have caught him that day. Back in
Do you think so? Yeah.
I think because Geraint was getting stronger each day that year. You know, I took some criticism last year for saying that it was a lucky win. I didn't mean it in that sense. I said it was, you know, because we got the Val Thorens stage, went to 60-odd kilometres, wasn't it, that day?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the cancellation of Teen, obviously, and Geraint was sort of poised, wasn't he, to win that year, his second tour. And yeah, I mean, he's on his day, he's clearly the best climber in the race, but certain question marks still, which is great for us, isn't
it? It's brilliant to watch. Yeah. Yeah, it's brilliant for the neutral spectator. I do think it filled me with joy a lot, that stage win today, realizing that he hadn't won a Grand Tour stage yet, because you forget he's still so young and you've mentioned his vulnerability. It makes it him really endearing. I remember interviewing him during lockdown, and he was back home in Colombia, and I haven't had much chance to interview him very much. So it was my first time really sitting and talking to him, and I was just blown away by how humble he is and how normal and how very much rooted in his background he is, you know. And I think you can't help but root for
a rider very gentle,
like that.
Isn't he?
Yeah, very gentle.
And his post-race interview today, the first thing he said was, I still can't believe it myself, which shows that what he's been through, in terms of his you know, self-doubt and things like that.
Seemed like everybody just hated the fact that women were boxing, and it was all my fault.
Coming soon on Eurosport, Raw.
Everyone looks at you as this hard, tough guy who, you know, never struggles, but that's not the reality. Everyone struggles.
Raw, stories of bravery, determination and talent, is available on all podcast platforms.
So Brad, Bernal in pink, is it too early for Ineos to take the jersey? Although, I mean, it seemed to me that this was a pre-planned attack, that although we've seen them throughout the past week take advantage of the gaps where they could put time into their rivals where they can, this felt like a pre-planned attack and a pre-planned win, and therefore Dave B has intentionally gone out
Absolutely.
And said, guys, go and take the jersey today and we'll defend it for the rest of the race.
Yeah, they don't even use terminology like go and take the jersey. It would have been let's put a plan together, let's see it through, let's commit to it and let's see what result we get. And that's the way they ride on the offensive. I wouldn't say it's too early. That, you know, they take the jersey when you take the jersey and you play your cards to, you know, on the days that you need to play them in order to get the most time. And that's a big statement of intent from Egan. They're a man down with Siakov has gone. So you're looking at eight riders plus Bernal in the jersey. That means they've got six riders to ride every day now for 2 weeks. That's a long way. I took the jersey with 14 days to go the tour, but obviously it was nine riders then, and we'd lost Sitsov back then. It's never too early. And it's never too late, as Chris Froome proved. So it's you've got to take it where you can. And I think he needs that confidence booster more than anything. He could have waited and waited and waited and never seen and realised. And like we saw in that interview, that what he's been through the last year and a half with injury, that he needed that confidence boost. And obviously the statement about his back as well, you know, that would be on his mind. And it's one of those things, is sort of hypochondriac, if that's the right word, in terms of like, he may not have a back worry, but any little niggle, you know, you'll start thinking shades of last year and, oh God, is it going to falter?
I think that whole question of early, is it too early to take a jersey, is slightly different when it comes to Ineos Grenadiers. Certainly when they ride a race like they're riding it this time around, and they traditionally do. With FDJ, for example, they took the Malia Rosa, they've got to change how they ride. They've got to go on the front. They've got to try to lead the race and protect their jersey. Ineos ride like that anyway, you know, and they've had Filippo Ganna obviously in the pink, but they weren't trying to defend that. But even when Attila Valter was in the pink jersey, Ineos Grenadiers are still setting the pace. They're still trying to race it from the front. So I don't think it's going to be that different for them. I think it's a different kettle of fish, really. If it was another team, maybe, but they're the team who've been most dominant so far.
You mentioned FDJ there, Ola. Attila Valter, 43 seconds behind now on GC. He's still a factor, although you presume he will go backwards as the race goes on. Remco Evenepoel, 15 seconds behind Bernal after Bernal took bonus seconds at the line today. We saw him not so close to Bernal in the final stages of the race today, not as close as we've seen him this week every time the race has gone uphill. He's almost been his shadow every time. There's even a sort of that chink of light that Bernal could get away. Evenepoel's been right behind him, and today he was a few riders behind, and that to me says it's just starting to crank up to the point where Evenepoel's finding this just that little bit more difficult.
I wouldn't say he's finding it difficult. I think he's naturally found his place within the peloton and within the GC after so long away. I don't think we would have ever put Evenepoel, you know, certainly 2 years ago, we wouldn't have said that he was a better rider than Egan Bernal. Egan Bernal, you know, was touted when he won that Tour de France that he could go on and win six or seven tours after that. That was the kind of level of kind of genius that he was being given and the tag he was being given. And in, you know, through his vulnerability and his sort of back injury and things like that, we've perhaps diminished him a little bit as a rider through uncertainty and put Remco up there with him. But Remco's a different type of rider. And I think, have to, you know, for, was he 20, 21 years of age? If he finishes on the podium at this Giro, then behind Egan Bernal, if he goes on to win the race, you know, that's his rightful place, I think. And I wouldn't say he's chinks in his armour, because if you take Egan Bernal out of it and Ciccone, Remco's right up there, and that he's leading the race.
Ciccone for Trek at 36 seconds in
brilliant
fourth.
Ride.
Not their main man, the Shark.
No, he fell away a little bit more. But Ciccone, first time riding for GC, I thought he was exceptional today. I really did. And he was actually closing in on Bernal, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he's had a brilliant race so far. And, you know, he's been brought back a few times in the early couple of stages anyway to try to protect Nibali. So you do wonder how much that's maybe cost him. But we were chatting to Sean Kelly earlier and he was saying, oh, he'll be in the bus home going out the back of the race in the third week. He's obviously very good in the mountains. He won the King of the Mountains here in 2019. But whether he can handle the tough climbing we've got to come. But I think a lot of that will depend on it always does, who can handle it the best, who can lose the least time. If you look at the likes of, you know, you say Evenepoel, chinks in the armour, not necessarily, he just didn't have that acceleration that Bernal had. We wouldn't have expected that. But with all the other contenders, they're so close together. I think for these stages, certainly at this stage in the race, it's about not losing too much time. The likes of Yates, Dan Martin, Hugh Carthy, and Vlasov, he's at a brilliant start as well. But making sure that you're not losing too much whenever whoever it is goes off the front, you know, that's, and then it comes down to the last couple of stages in the third week. And that's kind of what we want. We want to make sure that all the big names are up there as close as they can be. We still have a top nine that's within 1 minute of the lead. So it really is anyone's race.
Vlasov at 21 seconds, you mentioned there. Simon Yates, though, he's nearly a minute behind already.
Yeah.
How's he going to be approaching this next week? I mean, Bike Exchange.
Bigging Simon up every day and saying that, you know, he's going to ride himself into this race. With every stage that goes past, we've got to see something a bit more from Simon. I'd say it was a little bit disappointing today. Is Simon riding to the level he's at the moment? I expected a bit more of him today, but it's very, very difficult. And as I say, that third week, you know, if he stays at this level, and if most of the riders in that group stay at this level, and Bernal falls away with a back injury, then it's all to play for. But Hugh Carthy was good today as well. Hugh was right there. Still, you know, steady Eddie, sixth on GC now.
I think Simon Yates has to show us a bit more of what he showed us on stage two of the Tour of the Alps. And that's the day that he went off the front, left everyone in his wake. And that's the reason we all got excited, to be honest.
Yeah.
Other than that, he won the Tour of the Alps, yes, but mostly because of stage two. Stage four, the other difficult stage, he stayed with everyone. He wasn't the one in front. So have we got a bit excited about Simon Yates in the run into this race? I have, and he was my odds-on favourite at the start. So far, he's safe, but he's not shown anything that would make us think he's the one to watch, certainly.
Yeah, I felt like he was riding with a level of freedom at the Tour of the Alps that we've not seen him able to do in the Giro so far.
He's not been without freedom here, though. He's just of the level of where he is, you know? The freedom comes with being the best in the race and being able to jump off the front. You know, if you can't do that, then you find yourself in the race where you should be.
Another Brit who was allowed to get away today was EF Simon Carr. We saw him in the breakaway.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about him. We were talking about him while watching him, and he hasn't come through the usual pathway of sort of British cycling and the talent team and things like that, but spent most of the time in France, I believe, growing up in France. But he really had a go today. He wasn't frightened. Education First, they're kind of like a team that they're a little bit dysfunctional in some ways, aren't they? And I think they've always been like that, and they've always seemed to race and get results like that. You know, they had two riders in that group. They had Hugh Carthy behind, and they never seemed to race as a unit. And they do get their freedom. They are a team that get their freedom, aren't they?
Yeah, Simon Carr is really interesting as well. And I was thinking about this while we were watching him today, and we learn an awful lot about riders as they go in the break. But born in Hereford, grew up in the foot of the Pyrenees near Carcassonne. But he kept his British racing license. He was registered in the UK rather than France.
Yeah.
He's Welsh origin. And he said his nan only realised he was actually a proper bike rider when he beat Geraint Thomas once. But I'm intrigued, actually, Bradley, as to how that changes things. Going through the British system as he would have done the age he is now compared to the French system. Do you know how different a grounding he would have in racing because of that?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the teams they end up in. I mean, Hugh Carthy's very similar. He went off to Spain and raced in Spain and didn't really come through the British system, although he raced for John Herity and the Rafa Condor team. But he very really went and paved his own way. And I think it reflects more in the way they race. You know, there's that sort of, aside from the fact we've never really heard of him. And a lot of those riders tend to end up with Jonathan Wouters. They kind of, Jonathan's always been a bit of a maverick and ended up,
this he always likes, godfather.
He likes the outsiders, you know, and the ones who sort of get forgotten about. And Jonathan sees something in people through kind of not being picked up by through the usual channels. And I think there's an element of, you know, the Yates and things, people like that that have come through the British system, either end up at obviously Green Edge or what was Green Edge because of the links between sort of Brailsford and Shane Bannon and people like that. Whereas Hugh Carthy and Jonathan likes an outsider, and Hugh Carthy's ended up there. And I said a few times that, you know, I don't think that Hugh should go to Sky or Ineos because I think it would change the way he races. And the beauty of that team is everyone gets their chance, and I think it reflects in the way they race as to whether they've come through the British system or not.
What was your relationship with JV like?
Brilliant. And it still is to this day, although I don't speak much with him. He's very intelligent. He's very articulate. He's very thoughtful, and he's not frightened of giving an opinion. But his opinions aren't always right, but he does believe in what he says. He doesn't say something just for the sake of saying it or to be controversial for the sake of it or contentious. He's just... he has his own vision and he sticks to it. And he's a man of his, you know, he's a man of his courage, of his conviction. And he believes in how he sees the sport should be. And he's always done that with that team. He's never changed the ethos of the team. And I respect the opinion he has, although I don't always agree with him.
He's almost not of his time.
You've interviewed him a fair few times, haven't you?
A lot, yeah. And
how would you describe him?
Pretty much exactly the same.
Yeah.
What I like about him is that he does have that courage of his convictions, but he doesn't necessarily always believe that he's right. He's not really always trying to convince you that he's right, that it's black or white.
No.
He's engaging in debate, which is really unusual in social media. And you get a lot of people, you know, in cancel culture and everything. It's got to be black or white. It's got to be right or wrong. With Jonathan, it's not. He'll make his point and he'll keep going on it. He will always have an educated, erudite argument to make, but it's not necessarily he thinks he's right. He thinks he's right, but he's not trying to make you see the error of your ways. No. He's just trying to get the debate out there, and he's really refreshing like that.
And
he's got
his theory to the problem at the time, and he's not frightened to change or say, well, I said this a year ago, but I actually think differently now. He's not frightened to change his opinion and admit that maybe that wasn't the right idea, but he only deals with the facts he has at the time and makes opinions formed on the facts he has at the time to whatever situation we're in. I mean, he's been criticised a few times, particularly the open letter he wrote last year at the Giro. And that was his, you know, he's not doing that. Whereas the likes of Lefebvre and Maddio and people like that, Maddio is quite staunch on his opinions.
Quite.
And Lefebvre, sometimes you sort of think he just sort of says things for the sake of saying it, just to be awkward. Whereas Jonathan, you know, he's got a real sort of vision of how the sport should be run.
And even the letter you're referring to, that's evidence of his character like that.
Yeah.
He's trying to be intelligent and he's trying to be thoughtful. And I almost felt bad about that because if you remember, it's the Giro d'Italia last year where they wrote an open letter to the other teams and to the organisers suggesting that they would call a halt to the race early because of COVID. He wasn't trying to lay that down as otherwise we will walk away from the race. He was trying to think of an intelligent way to deal with it. And I felt like I got that story and we ran it on Eurosport and it became a big deal. And I felt like he almost had to back away from that stance a little bit because he wasn't trying to be disrespectful to the race. No. It was the opposite.
He was trying to be responsible to his riders.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Just to bring it back to today and the major incident in the first sort of 60 kilometres or so. I mean, I said it was explosive at the end. It was explosive at the beginning today. And the peloton was so strung out. An attack after attack was trying to get away. A large group at the front finally did. And we saw Bahrain Victorious lighting it up, obviously going for stage wins now that they've lost their GC man in Mikel Landa. But Matej Mohoric in the break leading the way, absolutely gunning it on a descent. And then we saw, I mean, thankfully, we say first of all, he seems to be okay.
Horrific,
but
wasn't it?
An absolutely horrific crash.
I didn't see it until we were on air, and I sighed on air. It was... you know, it's very rare you see a crash of that nature and to have it on cameras as well. But it was good to see him stood at the end, wasn't it?
You don't see riders going over their heads very much, thankfully.
No.
But it was really horrific. And yeah, he stood at the end when he came off, but then he sat back down again, didn't he?
Yeah.
And it seemed like he
was going to get back on his bike. Mm. The team
thankfully
car stopped.
He didn't.
Yeah, thankfully he didn't because it was, you know, as you both said, it was such a shocking crash. Even his front forks snapped in half, and so the, his front wheel was.
Well, I think had he got on and carried on, I think we saw a similar thing with Romain Bardet. They'll pull you anyway, which is a good thing. I think we need more of that in cycling, but I'm just glad he's okay, you know, and I'm sure we'll have a sore head the next few days.
Our best wishes to him after having to abandon the race. Thankfully, able to walk away. We'll be back with more from the Bradley Wiggins Show after this. Zwift is the world's training playground, Brad, where fun takes you further, recreating the outdoor feel of riding on an indoor trainer, something you can get on board with, I think.
It does, yeah, and Zwift have done it very well, and they're now the leaders, aren't they, in that world, and they've got the likes of Geraint Thomas on board, and, you know, probably can't get...
Your old mate, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, they did some involvement with Team Wiggins a few years ago. We joined in one of their shops, Pinarello shop races one night, and... My son uses it. I watch him during the winter months. It's something I wish I'd had when I was 15. Definitely, just to, from a safety point of view, when you didn't want to let your kids out on the road in the dark.
And anyone can use it. So it, you know, you don't have to be G. You don't have to be a pro. You can train with thousands of real people.
Yeah. Like, you can train with anyone. You can ride with anyone from the world of pro cycling or from your workplace or school, whatever age you are.
Brad, like you say, most of the pros on the world tour train on Zwift.
Yeah, hop on anytime, heart pumping, intense cycling, join group rides, events, and worldwide races.
Zwift has 9 worlds too, including the stunning Paris and France maps. They've recreated Tour de France stages, which gives everyone a chance to experience them. You don't have to have been Bradley Wiggins to experience what it's like to ride at the Tour de France. You can hit your kilometres with virtual dinosaurs, raging waterfalls. You can be inside a volcano, James Bond-esque, a wide open California desert. Plus, you can tour London landmarks.
All you need is a bike, trainer, and Zwift app.
You can get a free 7-day trial, Brad, no strings attached, at Zwift.com. Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggins Show, sponsored by Zwift, where fun is fast. Orla, we saved this one until you've rejoined us this weekend, specifically for you, because I know that you've had strong opinions on it in the past. But the news this past week that Tour de France organiser Christian Prudhomme has confirmed that there will be a women's race in 2022. More details on that to come in October. We understand it will be run directly after the men's race.
Right, that's interesting, yeah.
I'm coming to you first, Orla, because I know that you, when we've spoken about it in the past, you've been quite negative about the prospect of a women's Tour de France. Is that fair to say? Probably not.
Probably more negative about the clamour for a Tour de France. And that's not to say anything against people who've campaigned hard for this. And I think they're campaigning for the right reason. So that's wonderful that they've been listened to. My problem with it has always been that once a year, when we have La Course by the Tour de France, which is the women's one-day race, we have so many column inches and so much social media space given over to this demand for a women's Tour de France. And I think if we would give the same energy to the amazing calendar that we have already and the races that we have already, then we would automatically, I don't know, triple our coverage in one single day of women's racing. And I feel like I've covered La Course for a number of years and it's not given the same weight that it should be given. It's not given the same publicity it should have been given. I remember being at the Tour de France one year when La Course was coming the next day and we were out doing an event that evening, speaking to cycling fans, people who are really happy that the Tour de France is coming into town, and they had no idea La Course was happening the next day. They'd had leaflets through their doors about road closures for the Tour de France, and they didn't know about La Course. And that made me angry because I thought these are cycling fans who are having the best of female races coming to their doorsteps and they don't even know about it. Mm. And so for me, I feel like there's been this huge demand for a women's Tour de France as if it's going to be some sort of a savior for women's racing. A, it doesn't need a savior. The women's calendar and women's racing right now is once in a generation amazing. And B, it has to be done properly. The other objection I have is that the same people who are complaining every year that we don't have a women's Tour de France often aren't even at La Course. And the difficulty of covering the Tour de France means it's going to be incredibly difficult for any journalist to stay on and cover La Course after they've just done 3 weeks in the road of France to stay on and give justice to the women's Tour de France. So I've got a lot of reservations about it. It will be amazing if it's done right. And I say welcome to the 21st century because they would have been in the wrong side of history. And I fear they're already in the wrong side of history waiting so long. But I do, again, still have reservations because Christian Prudhomme has talked about, and he's been criticised about this, but he's talked about the loss that women's racing engenders, so that they lose money. To me, if you're a business person, losing money is also investment. And we need to talk about investment, and we need to talk about it in a positive way and not expect a failure before it's even started. And I know that William Fotheringham, who did the interview with Christian Prudhomme, said that he listened back to the interview and it was full of enthusiasm and positivity, and he didn't want that quote to be taken out of context. However, it was said, and that is a massive, massive problem in women's racing. We're always talking about the money that's lost. What about the men's races that lose money? And what business in the history of enterprise has ever gotten off the ground without losing money first? It's called investment. You grow on it, you build on it, and you start with a proper vision to make it work.
Is that the right time to do it, directly after the men's tour?
Well, like I was going to say, what is done right for you, Viola? What is that, 3 weeks long?
No, not necessarily. I think I would rather see a 10-day race. Yeah. I think a week is a little bit short.
Because I think if it comes directly after, 3 weeks, like you say, just to keep the cavalcade on, it's going to be difficult. A bit like the Paralympics is, isn't it? And I still don't understand where this sort of logistically why it cannot be run at the same time as the men's.
I mean, it is really hard because of the length of days that you've got already at the Tour de France. You have an entire team, obviously, as you know, who put up the stage start every day, do the stage finish every day, and they move on. You've got the road closures already, which are incredibly long. And like I say, the journalists and the teams and the TV crews on the ground are already broken. I mean, you know, at the first rest day, never mind 3 weeks in. And so this is why at La Course, for example, the journalists who are there for the Tour de France often don't come and cover the start of La Course because it's too tiring.
Are we still going to have La Course? Is that the plan?
We're still going to have La Course as well.
As well as,
But I should say that the UCI regulations are that you cannot have a 10-day women's stage race at this stage. But I think for the variety of terrain that we'll need to see to make it a proper race, and given that the Giro Rosa has now been downgraded, it's no longer a women's world tour race, we need to see something that's going to properly showcase women's racing. If it works out, brilliant. It will be fantastic. If it's used, however, as a yardstick as to where we are with women's racing, that's when there's a problem. Because if people look at a women's Tour de France, it loses some money, they don't run it after a couple of years,
that's it.
Women's racing isn't ready for it. That's total rubbish. We see the best racing of... Between men and women's racing right now, women's racing is equivalent, you know, at least.
Of course, last year was the best race of the...
Incredible. Yeah. And the women's Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which, to be fair, is an ASO race, but it's one of the best races I've seen in recent years. A lot's riding on it, and I hope they take that responsibility seriously.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned being on the right side or the wrong side of history. I mean, they're already 31 years behind. By the time they get going, they'll be 31 years behind the Giro Rosa. Should we be looking at the Giro Rosa?
And that's getting downgraded.
Yeah,
was it
one step forward, two steps back?
I can't see the logic in that at all.
Again, it's the problem with race organisers, really. They didn't put on live coverage of the race last year, and that's what you need to be a Women's World Tour race. You need at least 45 minutes every day of racing, and they didn't do that. I'm quite glad that it's been downgraded for that reason, because these rules have to be in place for a reason, and races and race organisers need their status stripped of them. But we've seen in the past where races have said, well, all right then, it's too expensive and too much hassle to put on a live stream, so we'll lose the Women's World Tour status. I think it will be a very good branding for women's racing to have a Women's Tour de France. The name matters a lot, but it's not as simple as getting a Women's Tour de France and that's it, job done.
We used to have one as well.
We did.
It wasn't called the Women's Tour de France.
No. Of course, it was Tour Féminin.
Yeah, and this one I think will be Tour de France Femme.
And there were still some of the most classic, iconic pictures and video footage from Leontine van Morsel and Jenny Longo going head to head on Alpe d'Huez back then. And that's how big it was. And even I remember still seeing the images of Jenny Longo stood on the podium with Bernard Hinault on the Champs-Élysées as the winner of the Tour de France and the Tour Féminin. They used to go up on the same time. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see if it's done right, like you said. I think that's going to be the deciding factor.
What's taken them so long?
Well, you know what? It's 2021 now. I mean, I got asked after the 2012 tour, should the women have a Tour de France? That's 9 years ago.
What did you say then?
Well, I said that they should have, yes. Yeah. But, you know, I guess when I was back then as the tour winner, when I look back now, I've sort of, having listened to what you just said, Ola, I felt it was the right thing to say at the time.
Yeah, of course. Exactly.
You know, because, you know, what is there? Is there a right answer? You know, I mean, I couldn't say, no, I don't think they could. I don't think they're ready for it. Because lots depends on it. Yeah, but how's it going to be run? I mean, your instinct is to say, yes, they should, because you want equality. But there's a lot more thought that goes into it as to how it's going to be done properly. And you do not want to have one and lose it after a couple of years, or get it downgraded, or get forgotten about.
But again, I think that it's almost unfair that you're asked that question, you know, because they're saying, why isn't there a women's tour to France? And we're focusing in the negative. And my thing has always been, you know, we've had the women's tour, for example, a week-long stage race in the UK, which has given equal prize money to the men's tour of Britain since its inception, I think it was. We've got amazing women's racing. And I feel like always concentrating on that lack is disrespectful to women's racing. And it's also showing a little bit of ignorance as to what racing there is out there already. So the question in itself shows a lack of understanding of the women's racing that there is.
Asking you that question directly after you've won the tour feels to me, it's like another lazy media question, that because now you've got the yellow jersey, you are asked every single question, everything that's wrong with cycling, right? You've got the yellow jersey. Tell us what the answer is to it.
I felt, you know, the need that I had to say, you know, why not? I mean, no one else was saying it, you know, it's someone's got to say something at some point, certainly from the men's side, and in a British voice, because obviously, you know, it's... I felt at that time no one was saying anything and no one was supporting. And after that, I was in contact with Rochelle Gilmore, and she was setting up Wiggle Honda, and I supported three of the riders out of my own pocket in that team after that. And, you know, it was just someone had to do something. And she did a lot for women's cycling, didn't she? And I just don't think enough is done, and enough, I don't think they get lent enough support from the men's side. And I don't think enough of the men, and the men at the top end of the sport, are saying enough. You know, it doesn't take, people need such little encouragement, you know, to make a difference as well.
It's a lot better now as well.
It's better, yeah.
Yeah, and
Tao's been very vocal.
Tao's brilliant. Yeah. Mark Cavendish has been brilliant as well. And it's sad to say, but it's a bit like Andy Murray, you know, in tennis. If a guy says it, people listen, you know. If women say it, people will say, well, that's what we expect you to say.
Mm.
But we do have more vocal supporters now. And it's easy to forget how far women's racing has come on in the last 3, 4, 5 years. It has grown exponentially, and it's only going to get better. And I hope that we just continue to focus on the positive.
The wider part of this conversation, and this is something that you spoke about in Relais, in February's edition of Relais that you guest edited, which was a women's edition, and famously, and as I said to you when we were talking about this yesterday, Orla, it was exactly the right magazine at exactly the right time. It sort of caught the moment of what is, well, what continues to become a proper movement now, what you feel with real momentum. But you spoke in, or you've spoken about, having guest edited that mag, that there is this this wider narrative, that the cycling narrative is a male focused narrative, because it's almost entirely written and reported on by men.
But that's the world, Graham. It's still the world. Everything is still written and reported. History is still written and reported by men, and it's a man's story. You know, this is why I love sport anyway, in that it's a reflection of everything. So cycling, yes, is a male domain, but it's only a reflection of everything else and every other industry. You know, it's not exceptional in that sense. And I wouldn't want us to think that cycling is a dark corner of the world. You know, as a woman in the wider world, it's still everywhere.
The success of that issue, I think, shows the potential for change, right?
And the appetite for change, and the appetite amongst men for change, which is the most interesting part for me, because Ruler has a largely male audience, a largely male readership, and it was the fastest selling and the biggest selling issue in Ruler's history. Both amongst the readership already, so the male demographic, we increased our female readership, I think, by a third subscriptions. But it was, you know, it's mostly men who read that magazine, and they were delighted to read of women's stories. Why? Because they're just stories. They're just stories. They're just good stories. It's just good narrative. It's just good storytelling, really. And that shouldn't be with a gender.
One of the pieces in that issue that stood out to me was you talking to Lizzie Deignan and Fran Miller. Monica Santini about your shared experiences within cycling, and whether that's the sort of, I'm going to call them the kind of microaggressions that you face every day, just simply because you're female working in the sport, to the sort of the wider barriers that you face as well. Even for example, the comments that you face on social media, for example, when you talk about, oh, I've been away for a couple of weeks and I'm missing my kids. And the responses you get to that, it just sort of seemed to me crushingly unfair.
Yeah, it's hard because you feel as a woman that you've got to represent everything and everyone. So I feel like I'm out there representing mothers. I'm out there representing women who want to work in sport. I'm out there representing people who don't want their gender to be counted and just want to be seen as a journalist or a presenter or just working in the sport. But yeah, on social media, I've had a number of occasions whereby I've referenced the fact that I miss my kids when I'm away from home. And then I invariably get comments from people saying, well, you've got a choice. Why are you doing it then? Go home and stay with your kids if that's what you want. Which, you know, there's validity to that, you know, and shoot me down for wanting a little bit of everything in life. But I find it interesting. Like, I think Bradley, you know, you're a father. And I think if you ever mentioned missing your kids because you were away racing, I don't think anyone would ever say, well, stay at home then, don't race. Yeah, you know, no, your job would be seen to be more essential in the family dynamic,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And then you get the sort of lines of, you know, well, it's all right for you, you get paid loads of money, you know.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
and
yeah.
I think
yeah.
there's all those sort of, you know, misconceptions and perceptions that come with it. But yeah, you're right. I think it's social media is a very funny thing as well. I think it's sort of, it's particularly Twitter, you know, it kind of encourages that sort of spontaneous, it's a very spontaneous thing. Mm. And people sort of tend to sort of air their things. It's a bit like the toilet door, you know, it's, yeah, and it's very, they're sort of pretty unintelligent and sort of unthought out kind of comments and things, because why shouldn't you be allowed to say how you feel, you know?
But it's funny how you say, you get people saying to you, oh, you earn loads of money, so it's all right for you. What I get is people saying, well, your job's disposable, you're the woman in the relationship, so surely you can just let your man work, without any understanding as to how much of the balance I bring to the financial setup or anything. But also the fact that I want my own career, and there's just so many more layers to it that you've got to pick away. But yeah, just keep fighting it, I guess.
Both in terms of gender and diversity, is cycling's problem, to sort of put a broader brushstroke on it, is cycling's biggest problem that it's just not inclusive? It's just
I think it is inclusive. I think it's become a lot more inclusive. I think Rafa's biggest sort of demographic is women that buy stuff now. And I think it's become a hell of, it's come a long way. It's like you were saying about focus on the negatives. You know, let's look how far it has come and how inclusive it is now for men and women.
Certainly in terms of
gender.
And
look at Pippa York, you know, and how she's received now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think let's not forget how far it has come.
Mm.
And I think that we look at the people who do it as being representative of attitudes or whatever. Most people who practice sports are still male. You know, that doesn't mean that women are always excluded. As long as you feel comfortable being able to take part in the sport, that's the main thing. And it's doing all right, really. I think in terms of...
Got a long way to go, isn't it?
Yeah, like everything. Mm. Like I say, yeah, like the whole world, you know, we need to be much more cognizant of making society more inclusive. I think when it comes to colour and background and ethnicity, then you get into questions as to how inclusive it is or how representative it is. You know, is the problem visibility or is the problem access? And that's something that I can't answer, and it's something that I'm interested in exploring. But it's always so much more complicated than boiling it down to inclusive, exclusive headlines.
All right, we'll be back with more from the Bradley Wiggins Show after this. Lacquer's collective cover is made especially for cyclists. This is bicycle insurance made for everyone, from Grand Tour winners to cyclists hitting the pedals for the first time. Lacquer has transformed traditional insurance with no more fixed upfront premiums. Instead, your monthly contributions are based on the collective's claims that month, meaning you could pay nothing if nobody claims. Your max monthly price is capped, but the savings are all yours. Claims are handled by Lacquer's team of cycling experts and usually agreed within a day, with no depreciation or excess. The Bradley Wiggins Show listeners can get their first 30 days free. Head over to www.lacquer.co and sign up using the code Wiggins. Brad, looking forward to, I mean, what we're all expecting to be an epic week of racing ahead at the Giro d'Italia, given, as Ola said, the gaps on GC are so tight. What can we look forward to this week, starting actually with stage 10 tomorrow, which is, we're expecting to
a
be
sprint.
A sprinter stage.
Minus Caleb Ewan, of course, who's been one of the fastest men in the race, if not the fastest. I think it gives a chance to the likes of sort of Gaviria, who we've been speaking about a lot the first week, and the form he's coming into.
He's been here, there and everywhere.
Yeah, he has, literally. Dylan Groenewegen, who's, we've spoke about the first weekend, but not so much this week.
Yeah.
It'd be lovely to see him win a stage.
Yeah.
And I expect them two to go head-to-head tomorrow. And then, of course, the rest day, and tomorrow as well, we'll see a very familiar sight in Ineos leading the bunch with Egan Bernal in resplendent his pink jersey.
Indeed. And the Maglia Ciclamino, Tim Merlier, Are you expecting to see any more from him? I mean, Alpecin Phoenix said that they came to this Giro looking for one stage win. They got that at the first possible opportunity. Anything else is a bonus. Are we expecting him to go on and challenge for the jersey now? I wouldn't have expected him to see the race through. To my mind now that Ewan has dropped, will he be looking at it thinking, I've got a real chance here?
Maybe, yeah. I still think that there's people further back. I think Nzolo. I think he could be the real contender.
Nzolo, that fierce the day that he was beaten by Caleb.
I think he'll be the biggest favourite for that jersey. I wouldn't discount Peter Sagan. Still present. And Viviani as well. He's been present, hasn't he? The last thirds, fourths, fifths. But Nzolo, he's got to pick up a win at some point. He's sort of been knocking on the door for a while now.
The perennial second place. He's taken the jersey before. But as we've talked about time and again, it seems over the past week, never actually taken a stage win at his home Grand Tour.
I think we've got to start seeing something from Jumbo-Visma. We saw today George Bennett going in the breakaway. He's lost an awful lot of time. Of course, he was their leader coming into this race. That breakaway didn't stick in the breakaway anyway. Koen Bouwman looked like he was going to be able to take the stage until Bernal came thundering past. It just shows how desperate they are. Maybe desperate is the wrong word. Determined they are to get something here. And I would be surprised if they weren't going all in for Groenewegen tomorrow. They don't have a GC anymore anyway. So now it's all about stage wins. So he's got to be one of their better options.
Absolutely. And minus Caleb, it gives an opportunity for all the others. They'll be all looking at it, thinking, particularly how dominant he was in that sprint a few days ago that we looked at. It was like a track sprint. They'll all realise that they've got a chance to win.
Mm. Stage 11 is one we're all really excited about. We talked about it a lot already. The stage to Montalcino, the stage that, as we spoke about on the pod yesterday, Brad, is an echo, really. I mean, the Giro loves a bit of history, doesn't it, to build that in?
Yeah.
With 35 kilometres of gravel sections. Yes. Given Bernal's podium at Strada Bianchi and given his success today, he's got to be licking his lips at that one, hasn't he?
He will, but I don't think he'll win the stage. I actually think Peter Sagan will win that day. Yeah, I think it's... it was interesting to talk to Cadel Evans earlier, which they're going to run out tomorrow. How much effort and how much preparation he put into that stage. And he doesn't think there'll be... He thinks more people are adopting that now on the bikes and tyres and things like that. But Sky clearly have really all over the sort of equipment side of things. But yeah, I think Bernal will be right up there. He'll have to be defending that jersey because the way the weather's been this race, we could have some rain that day.
Moving on to stage 12, another one we think for the GC, 4,300 metres plus of climbing there. Is that one for Simon Yates to start to
well,
bring
you'd
some
hope
time
so,
back?
But as I said earlier, I would have thought we'd seen a little bit more of him now to say yes on that. I think today was the real sign of where everyone's at now. I think the level has been, that's the true sort of level of the GC. The gentleman who had the pink jersey, forget his name now.
Attila Valter.
Yeah, he's obviously fallen away now. And I think this is a true reflection of what we're going to see the next 2 weeks now. Evenepoel, I wouldn't say fell away today. I think he just found his level. Ciccone, he's going to be right up there. I actually think Ciccone could win that gravel stage. He'd be pretty good on it. Bernal's clearly the strongest in the race, but question marks over his back. Simon, I fear for him a little bit. I'd like to have seen a bit more from him. Maybe that's the fan in me or the realist. I'm not too sure. But I don't know. What do you think? How do you see, Orla?
I just wonder with all of these. I mean, I think with Simon Yates in particular, we expected too much from him. You know how when we're watching from home, we've no idea what's going on inside a team camp. Yeah. But we've no idea of any illnesses or, we saw Cameron Meyer at the back the other day with stomach problems. We saw Tim Relier having to drop off and do a Dumoulin. You never know what kind of health issues are going on inside a team. Someone like Simon Yates, for example, this is complete speculation, but it wouldn't be surprising if something was rumbling underneath the surface and then he were to come good a little bit later in the race and he's sort of containing himself, because I'm surprised to not see him up there a little bit more. I mean, he's not doing badly, but he's not just showing the form we expected from him.
Well, the question marks were over Caleb Ewan and what we found out this morning as to why he came at the race. Someone had took his shoe cleats off and put them back on and slightly out, and he's got a knee problem. And that just, you think that's mind-boggling that would go on to someone who's won a couple of stages, fastest man in the race, Miraglia Cicolomino, and he's out the race because someone took his shoe cleats off.
Yeah.
I mean, if that was at Ineos, someone would be sacked. It's just the craziest sort of, I mean, there must be more context to it, but maybe he asked for him to be changed, who knows? But it just shows you that just the smallest change, smallest thing can upset a rider.
That brings us to the end of this episode of the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, brought to you by Zwift, where fun is fast. Brad, we'll be back for a special edition of the pod on Tuesday.
Stage 11.
Where you'll be speaking to Cadell and we'll be, previewing the stage. Orla, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Real pleasure to have you. Thank you. And good luck this week, week two of the Giro on GCN.
Should be
Eurosport.
Fun. Can't wait.
Yeah. Brad, we can follow you on social.
There we go.
So we go. Orla, we can follow you.
At Sports Orla.
You can follow Eurosport on Twitter at Eurosport_UK. Plus, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Thanks to our producer, Pete Burton. And finally from me, Graham Wilgos, it's goodbye. If you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, share your thoughts and rate us. Brad, that special edition on Tuesday.
Yep, looking forward to it.
Looking forward to that.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.